Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. And today we welcome special guest. You probably know this guy from his string of solo albums from the 80s into the 90s. He's been a songwriter for many years, multi-instrumentalist. We're going to talk about all that and a lot of cool stories from his early days and his more current stuff, too. So please welcome to the show, Jeff Paris. Jeff, how are you?
Hey, everybody.
Welcome to the show and happy new year and a slightly belated happy birthday to you.
Thanks, man.
And that was
Thank
last
you very
week.
Much. Happy new year.
I don't think we remembered your birthday.
Yes. I have nothing to hide about my chronological journey.
There you go. No, me and Tom, I'm about what, 10 years, 11 years older, younger than you, than Tom. So,
but you guys are still beating around the bush.
Yeah,
I'm a very spry 66. So I mean,
I just turned 73.
Okay,
so pretty good for an old fart.
Yeah, I'm 54. So yeah. I'm the young
my youth.
Yeah.
Back when I was a kid at 54.
Yeah, and you're a kid, right? I don't feel like a kid. I'll tell you that.
Well, you'll see.
It's all relative.
It gets worse, huh?
The other shoe hasn't dropped yet.
Exactly.
But I wanted to talk to you about, you know, we want to cover your whole career because you've done so much stuff. I mean, a lot of people, if they're the AOR crowd listening to us, they're going to know, you know, your solo albums, your five solo albums. But you've done so much more before, after. I want to start out, and I was reading your bio on your website, and I found a really interesting story I wanted to ask you about. Sure. Your younger days, when you were a little kid, living with your, you know, in your parents' apartment. Talk about that story where Jimmy Van Heusen was your neighbor, and I found that really interesting because Jimmy Van Heusen, a composer from the 50s, wrote Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra songs, right? Even he was the co-writer of the Love and Marriage song that everybody knows from Married with Children from the 80s.
Yeah.
You know?
No, he's just a really gifted guy. I was born in 1951, and at the time, my dentist father had kind of newly minted. I was working for a guy in Manhattan Beach, and we lived in an apartment on Westwood Boulevard, which is near UCLA in Los Angeles, in the Westwood Village area. And I kind of knew about that. I'd always known about that. But I'm trying to figure out how to condense this, but still give you the kind of bullet points, which is I'm currently, you know, really consumed with jazz study, elevating my pianistic ability to a much higher level than I ever planned on doing. And I mean, it's great that you guys said, oh, everybody's familiar with this. Or, yeah, I don't consider myself that well known. I play a lot of different instruments, and I came to piano a little bit late, but that dominates my interest instrumentally. So anyway, back to when I was taken home from the hospital, we went to this, we lived in this apartment. The thing about jazz and my consumed, study is that this all came up over, since I was like maybe 55, your age. Mm-hmm. So that's relatively recent. I mean, in the sense that if you're really going to be serious about it, you're going to have to transform yourself if you really haven't played jazz all your life. But I got really hooked on standards. And then by extension, all of the great, you know, killer jazz legacy songs and material. And I wanted to play it really well so that I didn't have to sing. And at the time I mentioned this to my mother, I said, you know, you always tried to get me to listen to jazz. You always tried to get me to sing like Bobby Short and play all those Frank Sinatra songs that you played to me when I was a little kid. And like a time bomb, that's all I want to do now. It's like, I don't want to do anything else. I got to, you know, I got to keep up my other music and my commercial stuff. And when I'm signed to a publishing deal, got to write pop songs, but it's all I want to do. And she goes, oh my God. Well, you know, Jimmy Van Heusen used to live upstairs. And when you first were a little baby, brand newborn, he was up at all hours in the night, pounding away at the piano, and you could never sleep and you'd be just listening to it all night long. So of course, and I'm looking at her going, when were you going to tell me this? Because it answers every question. It is so in my bones that I have this sort of, you know, DNA.
Yeah.
So that's the story. As a newborn, my road to rock and roll was Jimmy Van Heusen, because that's the first music I ever heard. Literally from day one. It's not even Jimmy Van Heusen's records or Frank Sinatra. It was the guy himself writing the tunes. And she said, and then at a certain point, all the Brat Pack guys would come over and then it would get really loud.
Wow.
I don't know if I absorbed any of that craziness, but, you know, so that was, and it was not long after that, my mother passed away. So she kind of dropped this bomb on me, you know, and, I'm all the better for it.
Well, your early time when you talked about, you know, getting into Beatles and Hendrix and stuff like that, did you, your first like foray into music, was that like as a sessions guy? Is that how you kind of got into professional?
I'll tell you, deciding to be a musician vocationally had nothing to do with my commitment to being in music. You know, I decided I was going to do music as my thing. You know, 14 years old, we don't even know anything about money or how to make it pay or anything. Yeah. But once I made the formal decision that that's going to be my career goal, it was based on the support I wasn't getting from my parents paled in comparison to the support I was getting from my community of really good musicians who were surrounding me and encouraging me. So I'm really grateful for that. And I'm sure that happens a lot.
Yeah.
When you run into a situation, you know, Tchaikovsky's dad made him be a lawyer or he was going to disown him. So this is an old story.
Yeah.
So I knew a shitload of songs by the time I was 14. Tell you the truth, my aptitude was so natural. I started at 8 playing folk guitar. I went to a wonderful lady who basically gave us a sheaf of music, lyrics with the chords written over. And she taught us how to play. And it was basically approaching music by learning a song. And that's called repertoire. Well, by the time I was 9 or 10, I could go play at a folk club for 2 hours. I was like a wind-up toy. You just put the guitar in front of me, sit me, and I could play. Wow. I knew about 50, 60 songs. And, you know, and there were other kind of signposts that, you know, college kids who would, you know, when I was at camp, would wake me up in the middle of the night and say, grab your guitar. And I'd go into this tent and there were like 6 18-year-olds with guitars going like, show us how to play that shit you play. And I'm like 11.
Yeah.
You know, so this was an indication that the outside world was telling me to manifest what I felt about my own. Because I was very insecure. No parental support. I didn't know what the hell to do about it. And I was, you know, I was going, no. I better be a lawyer. Or I better be this, you know. And then older college age kids would say, you're out of your mind. So that gave me the bravery it took to, you know, to like, you know, turn the Titanic away from the iceberg. You know?
Yeah.
You kind of became synonymous as an AOR artist. Was that a type of music that from a earlier, you know, in your life you saw, or you just kind of grew into that, being that it kind of like in the mid 80s there was a scene for it? How did you fit into that niche right. that became synonymous with your name?
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out how to shorten my responses to you guys, but it's kind of hard, and that's a big subject. So if you need me to cut it short.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you know, that's...
You know, tell me to shut up or something. So here's the thing. The genesis for that was I emancipate myself from my parents. I quit the boarding school. I dedicate myself to music, and things start happening. And one of the main things that started happening is in junior college, I met a guy named Jay Gruska.
Oh, that's very familiar with him.
We were best friends. And we became best friends. And I was going to Los Angeles City College, as he was. And our goal was to get some kind of music education, get our literacy up, learn our instruments better. You know, maybe we'd try to get a transfer and go to college. It was all kind of up in the air. I don't know what Jay's story was. He should have gone straight to Berkeley with all of his abilities. But, you know, Berkeley was an ambiguous kind of a thing we didn't know about back then. You know what Berkeley is, right? Berkeley School of Music. Yeah. Yes. And now you'll see the most, you know, the most, all of the guitar virtuosos.
All the whittly diddly guys went there.
You know, the whittly diddly went there, and they're fantastic, and it is a beautiful, I wish I'd gone. So we live down the street from each other, right off of Franklin Boulevard in Los Angeles. We see each other at school every day, and then we'd hang out. At night, we'd you know, play guitars together, and Jay started playing me the songs he was writing. And I loved him. Earlier, I have the best man at my wedding, my best friend was John Keller, and he learned to play guitar specifically so he could write songs. And I thought, kind of think, Jay, there's like two kinds of songwriters. The ones who learn to play musical instruments so that they can write songs. They plan on writing songs right out of the gate. And then there's the latent guys like me who have no intention of music. I loved learning songs that had already been written. I hear a song I want to do, and then maybe I change it and make it my own. And I was really very precocious about that. Like, I'm not going to play it like them. I'm going to slow this or speed it up. So I loved working with my buddy, John, and I loved working with Jay. As soon as I heard his songs, I said, that's great, but if you did this, and he goes, oh, that's a great idea. Never considered myself a collaborator. I was just like an arranger. And I said, so what are you going to do? He said, well, I got this band, and I went down to where they rehearsed, and they were pretty good. They were one of these kind of bands that they'd have a great eight bars, and then they'd have like a kind of a thing where the time would sag, or it just, you know, would start to lose energy. And I said, Jay, you're freaking songs. I want to help you, but you got to get a new band. And I know just who to get. So I got him Mark Sanders, who ended up playing with Tower of Power. Chris Pinnock, who ended up playing with Chicago. But we were all kids. We were all young. And David Edelstein, who was a really precocious bass player. And I brought Jay, and we had a rehearsal, and it sounded really good. It was really fantastic. And so we spent about a year and a half doing showcases. And I was kind of the MD. Jay gets a deal. Joel Cohen, who you might remember from the, possibly from the Yacht Rock video, managed or co-managed Steely Dan at the time. He ended up managing Jay. He discovered Jay at one of our showcases or something. And he told Jay after his record was made, which we didn't play on, that if he's going to go out on the road, he really needs to get a road season band, and that, you know, it's a tough call, but he, you know, same thing they told Edie Brickell, right? You got to get real pros. And So at the juncture of my final year at LACC, and when I thought I was going to go out on tour with Jay, he let us all go. And I'm sitting there in my apartment on Fountain Avenue. It really was a little guest house, like a Nick Carraway house. It was like really sweet. And I'm sitting there sleeping 10 hours a day, as depressed as I could possibly be. And it occurred to me that it all had to do with songwriting. And the songwriter is the king. So before my, goal of session guy or touring musician guy had a chance to really coalesce, because I was, back in LA in those days, you couldn't even play clubs unless you were over 21, So, things were just starting to get started at an age when in other states, you could go in and they let you play as long as you took your breaks in the alley, So this was the first significant vocational move that I had the light bulb, eureka. I said, from now on, I'm a songwriter. It's like a promotion you can give yourself, and you still don't even have to have ever written a song, but that changes everything. It's like
Changes
Deepak
your
Chopra said,
mindset. Yeah, your
yeah, it's a
mindset has
mindset.
changed.
And so at the time, the kind of songs that were being written, we're talking about the 70s, it was pre-disco. So, it'd be like Madman Across the Water, as a Elton John. I listened to the radio all the time, and I loved the songs I heard on the radio. So it was a real easy kind of a process for me to want to join the great community of pop songwriters. Now, the significance of that is because other guys, when they start writing songs, want to write songs that are expressions of their own innermost thing, and they don't want to do what's on the radio. I wanted to be part of the system. So that was good for me. Good for me that I realized that. Top 40 radio. I wanted to be able to write top 40 radio songs. I liked playing them. I liked performing them. I liked performing covers. Now I was going to be a contributor. However, as a side note, I sat down for 2 weeks after I finally got my act together, in terms of getting, I pulled myself up out of my depression and started sitting at the piano with a cassette machine and paper, and nothing, I started getting parts and I couldn't figure it out. And I immediately went into the friggin' depths of depression again, And remember, this is early 70s. Songwriting wasn't something that a billion people wanted to do. Now, after 50 years of evolution, it's the thing people want to do right away, as well as being a virtuoso musician. And now you can go to, school and learn to be a songwriter, but there was no classes in songwriting. So you had to just kind of like hope for the touch of God or some insight that just occurred to you. And it wasn't occurring to me. And at the time, I would fall asleep at the piano, and wake up and keep writing. And then I'd fall asleep at the piano, an hour and a half later. And then I'd wake up and my mother would call me. And I sounded like I was frigging, as she said, I thought you were on hard drugs. And I wasn't. I was just struggling. But at the time, she had, the story?
Yeah. So you just to stop you, you knew Jay Gruska long before he put out an album in the 80s called Which One of Us Is Me,
Oh,
which
it's way before
way
that. It was
before
his
that,
first.
okay.
We helped him get a deal on ABC Dunhill, and
Right.
Michael Lamartine, the great yacht rock producer,
Oh, yeah.
was the guy who produced the record. So I'll try to get through this little thing.
He was also in a band
Basically,
called Maxis, too.
that's right, and that was still after what the time. I'm talking about Embryonic Jay,
Okay.
Embryonic Jeff.
You were all
This was
young
our
guys.
formative, but this is the origin story. So at the time, Marvin Hamlisch had won two Academy Awards, and my mom thought, God, he sounds just like Jeff when he talks. He's glib and he's articulate. And so she looks in the phone book under Hamlisch with the idea of like, my son needs a mentor. And she lives in Los Angeles, and Marvin Hamlisch doesn't live here. She didn't even know that. You know, he's got a New York accent. So she calls the first Hamlet in the phone book, and she gets his mother. And he just happens to be staying at her apartment because he had just won an Academy Award. So he's staying in LA for a couple of weeks. Anyway, I get this call from Marvin Hamlet. She said, "Jeff, your mother told me to call you." I swear to God. And I said, "You don't have to do this, man." It's just, he says, No. He said, "You know what, Jeff? Mothers are smart." She gave him a little credit. "Now, what are you doing with your music?" And we talked for 2 hours. And Marvin Hamlisch went through everything you've just gone through with me. He said, "What are you doing with your music?" I said, "Well, you know, I'm thinking about trying to be a session guy and a touring guy." He goes, "Well," he said, "I went to Juilliard. It takes a, you know, it's a rare bunch of attributes that you're gonna need to be a session guy." And then he said, "Touring? How long are you gonna do that? You know, it's a bit, well, I love touring and I'm 73 and I'm still on tour." So, you know, he didn't know everything, but I think he automatically was, he said, "You know, what about songwriting?" I said, and then I told him the story about Jay and that I was now kind of like at loose ends, and I realized that songwriting is the platform from which you can spring in all directions. And then I got into a band, and we got signed to UA Pieces, and all of this was kind of R&B flavored pop. The band broke up. The 80s started. Disco bit the dust, as you know. And the new wave of English artists and punk, like The Clash and Haircut 100, started to look to be what was going to happen next. 1981, 1982, the US Festival. Steve Wozniak had split with Steve Jobs, cashed out. He had $1 billion, and they said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm going to put on what was the precursor to Coachella. It's called the US Festival. 4 days categorized as new wave, pop, hard rock and heavy metal, and some other thing, folk or something like that." I pick up the calendar section on Sunday, and at that time in the LA, the calendar looked like the Rolling Stone. It was like 60 pages. And there were like eight, you know, it was like music had taken over the public imagination more than film. This was late 70s, early 80s. And the headline was US Festival, Rock Wins. And I opened it up and it said that one day of melodic hard rock, heavy metal, and you know, Journey, Foreigner kind of stuff, did twice the revenue of all the other days combined.
Yeah. I remember hearing
And I had just been signed to Almo Irving as a songwriter. By that time, I'd had Jeffrey Osborne covers. So this is all basically what I did in the 70s was
So this is 1983 now we're talking.
1982 was when this came out. The US Festival was 1982. And that's, now I wasn't the only one who picked up on this, but I called my publisher, Alan
Were
Ryder.
there more than one US festivals, or there was just the
This
one?
was the first
That was the one.
one, Tom.
Just the
This was the
one? Just the one.
very,
83.
again, remember me,
Yeah,
I'm the
go
guy
ahead.
born in 1951. I'm telling you, I was on the ground floor of so many things, it's hilarious.
It was
You
83.
know?
No, it was 83. Van Halen, Triumph, Judas Priest, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was
Except
heavy
the
metal
US
then.
Festival was before that. It was 1982.
Oh, so there was one actually before that, like a lesser publicized one?
It was the very first one is the very first one, and I'm pretty sure it was 82. But it might have been 83.
Was 83. If we're talking about the one that had Judas Priest and Triumph and Van Halen, it
Okay.
was 80. It was,
Okay,
yeah, it was
that makes
83.
sense because there was a full 2 years of punk and new wave. Elvis Costello came out,
Yeah, it's
right?
83. Yeah,
And
he
The
played at
Clash,
that.
right?
Yeah.
And so that was 81, 82. 83, it was like we were getting ready to, you know, if I, you know, I was convinced I could still write R&B pop. But when I picked up the paper and read that, I rushed down to my publisher and I said, "You got any rock acts?" He goes, "Rock acts? We signed you as an R&B writer, man." I said, "Look at this." It was like Doc Brown, you know, when he sees the poster and Marty McFly, and he says, "There's no way we're going to get you Back to the Future." And he goes, "What about this?" And he shows him the poster with the bell towers. He grabbed the thing. He went, "This is it. This is what's going to happen." I said, "I know." He goes, "Let me make a couple of calls." Next thing I know, I'm writing with Lita Ford and Y&T. And that was my summer of Lita Ford and Y&T. And I wrote Gotta Let Go and Hit and Run for Lita. And the whole In Rock We Trust record
You
with
co-wrote every song on
So
that.
you co-wrote
Every song.
that commercial Y&T record that the hardcore fans like myself absolutely hated.
Yes, I did. Guilty as charged. But they made more money off of that than
I
all the
know
rest of the records combined. And I still, you know, I talk to Dave about this all the time, and I'm in the video, you know, the Y&T video. The
Oh, are you really?
yeah, I'm horrible. I'm like talking faster than I am now.
I hated that record.
I'm sorry, but it's a really good record. But the hang with Dave and Phil Kennamore and Joey and Lenny was absolutely superb.
I could
I
only
mean,
imagine.
it was, I mean, and I'm a kind of a studious guy, you know. I mean, I do the shit nobody else wants to do, you know, instead of going to the bar normally. But when I spent the summer with that band, it was like all bets were off. We ended up in Miami at Bill Simcik's studio to finish the overdubs for In Rock We Trust. And that's the famous studio that the Eagles cut Long Run in Miami. And it was in an industrial park, the cinder block building, you know. And they put everybody up. We were all, the whole band and I were living in a, actually, I think it was just Dave and Phil and me, not Joey and Lenny, because they were done with their basic tracks. So we were in this little condo, you know. The engineer, I can't remember his name, and Phil and Dave and me. And so we would finish working in the studio, and there was a bar across the street, and Dave would go like, "Nah, I'm not gonna go." Me and Phil, I hate to say it, it was every night. We would walk in and we would crawl out on our knees across the street,
No, I
you know.
believe it. Yeah.
And we had the metabolism to wake up the next day totally fine and go in and do all our shit. But it was that's a movie. Between the work we did at Fantasy Recording, and I'm there, I am in San Francisco having the time of my life hanging out with those guys, and we did hard work. And I did they basically, after I finished the three songs that I went up there to write with them, I thought, well, I was just going to write three songs. And I'm back home and I get this call, and Dave says, "Man, you got to come up and write the rest of the shit with us." I go, "God, I'm signed to, well, we'll fix it." So they called Almo, my publishing company, and they said, "You know, go ahead, go up. It's okay. They're going to get you a car, you know, you stay at the Miyako, and you're going to work every day." And I said, "Great." I get there, and Tom has budgeted me, for at the time was pretty good dough, $1,500 a week, on
Then,
top
oh,
of my
yeah, that's great.
regular salary from the publishing company, you know. And I would have done it for free. But yeah, so
They were a
and then the
very
lead.
unique band. They had something, beside Menichetti, Leonard Hayes was a drummer at that time that got more attention. There hadn't been a drummer since John Bonham that got the attention with his style that Leonard Hayes had. People would go just nuts for his, he played one bass drum, but it sounded like he was playing three of them. He had, it used to be called Thunderfoot, which I'm sure you know. And Kenamore had a great, Kenamore was like the US version of Pete Way in UFO. He had a presence, the rock star presence that as soon as he hit the stage, you just gravitated to him. He was this tall guy, and and he was always dressed like super cool, and they just had something about them that was very different.
Did you ever meet him?
I never met him. I've seen him many times, very close up. You know, like I've seen.
So here's the thing: Phil Kennamore was absolutely the sweetest, non-ego. He had no ego. He had this fucking great smile, and the hang with Phil, and you could tell him anything. I mean, if you were like, you know, getting weirded out about something, you know, he was a freaking saint, married to this beautiful Persian lady. They had this cool little apartment, and we wrote all the lyrics at his kitchen table for the full friggin' record.
Really?
And he was like butter. The guy, under the hood, Phil, the exterior of Phil and the interior of Phil, you would never, he was not a peacocker. He was not a, you know, self-aggrandizing, cocky cat. Just the most genuine, just wonderful. Just a wonderful guy.
He had stage presence without trying to put it on. He's one of those guys, as soon as he walked on the stage, he was like, well, that's what a rock star looks like. Mm. And he wasn't even doing it. He was just standing there.
No, it's natural Phil, because right. Phil was so into the music, man.
Right.
They all were.
So how did your debut album, Race to Paradise, finally come to fruition?
So in the process of all of this attention for my songwriting, I had expressed to, I ended up getting managed by Lita's manager, who called me to have a meeting with me about Lita and about maybe playing on her record, which is a whole other story. Because Lita didn't want anybody to play on her record. But so I was a little naive and kind of got manipulated into doing things that I probably wouldn't have done if I'd known the repercussions. But point is, I think he wanted to manage me as a songwriter because he saw me as a up-and-comer. Alan Kovac, you know him?
No.
I've seen the name on... Yeah, I don't know exactly.
He became known as an exhumer of of rock acts that.
I thought you were going to say bodies.
Well, no, I mean, I'm being metaphorical. I'm a songwriter. Right. We're talking metaphors and poetry. So sorry. He would reanimate bands that had not been recording. So Meatloaf. Mm. Meatloaf's back into hell. Mm-hmm. The rise of Meatloaf, and I do anything for Lebanon. All that's Alan. Alan.
Okay, Alan, I mean, that's where I know the name from. Yeah,
yeah, right. And he was managing Jeff Lorber and Karen White on the other side. He was a great guy, really, really great times with him. And then then it flipped and got crazy, but. He said, what are you doing? And I said, well, you know, man, I want to get my own rock deal. And this is the whole thing, man. When I picked up that article in that newspaper, I had 100% comprehension of how the next 10 years was going to go. It was one of those, we probably all, have some form of perception about something, whether it's, going to the poker game and folding or not folding, it's like we suddenly figure out the way through. And I read that article and I knew all of my experience with rock music because I was completely immersed in it, until I evolved into this R&B thing out of necessity because that's what was going on in the 70s.
Yeah.
But it was still, the motor was just on idle. It was all ready to go. It was all ready to take off again. And as soon as I saw that, I went, yay, and I grabbed my guitar and I started, I picked up, all of the songs that I, as a player that I knew how to play, I then learned how to write. I just was writing different kinds of music, but then I just took my songwriting ability and I applied it backwards into a style of music that I loved to play when I was younger. So
So you got signed to Mercury. That was the first label you were on as a solo artist?
That's it. I had a major label deal. And Alan Kovac, when I told him that I wanted to try to get my own deal and do my music, he went for it. And I think the following year I got signed.
You were an in-house writer for Mercury, or
Later, I
okay.
was with Almo, A&M Records Publishing, while I was making the record. And then I made a second record, Wired Up. So the first record was Race for Paradise. But the real thing about this was Alan, I'm gonna revise what I just said. Alan would have, what I didn't know when Alan said, okay, we'll try to get your record deal, is that Lance Quinn had sent my demos of me singing my songs to Derek Shulman. And he told Derek Shulman that this motherfucker is fucking great. He is fucking great. And then he called Kovac and said, Alan, you got to manage Jeff. I'm going to try to get him a deal with PolyGram. So Alan cooperated and they teamed up. And Derek absolutely dug my shit, dug what I was. I wanted to use studio rock players. And Alan said, no, because if you're going to go on tour, you got to find, well, you know what happened to all the bands that had, their own grassroots members. First guy to not go into the studio to cut him was the drummer. But I'd heard about Pat Torpy. And Pat had just finished playing with some band. Was it UFO? Was it
He was
was it
with
Harold?
Robert
He
Plant.
played with
He
Robert
was with
Plant.
Robert Plant for quite a while.
No, this is before then, man. This is before
Before.
Pat Torpy had just started gaining notoriety, and he had been in a band that had made a record that tanked, and it was a really bad experience for him. So he didn't want to be in a band anymore. But everybody said, if you can get him, he's great. So I said, well, how do I get him? He goes, and somebody said, well, he plays softball down at Beamon Park in Studio City. So I went down to Beamon Park with my demos or something. And I went around asking, are you Pat Torpy? Are you Pat Torpy? It's like my mom calling Marvin Hamlisch. And
Right.
I finally, and somebody, no, but he's right out there, and they're coming into bat. So he comes in, Pat Torpy looked like a male model. I mean, he just was a
Yeah, he
great
was a
looking
really good
guy.
looking guy, yeah.
He's just, and he looks at me and he goes, man, I'm really flattered you wanted to do this, but the thing about it is I just don't think I want to be in a band. And I said, just try it. Just try it. And I got him to do it. And but we didn't tour. Roger Feetz was, I auditioned bass players and I got Roger. They wanted me to find a guitar player to be in the band so that and it was a great idea. A lot of things were great ideas that I didn't recognize at the time. I know you guys probably know about that. The kind of guitar players like Jimmy Crespi, right? Well, I'm no Mike Thompson, but Mike Thompson says, Jeff, there's aspects of my guitar playing that I learned from Jeff. So I had an influence on him. So I had the chops to be able to. So I said, hey, Mike, teach me how to play the song on my record that we co-wrote. And in the process of learning the parts that he played on our song, I expanded all of that into upgrading my technique so that I was going to have to find a guy like me or him to be my second guitar player. And nobody could cop the parts. So I just, like Dave Menichetti, I just played him myself. And it was a real bitch because I couldn't run around while I was playing these big fucking things. They were like,
Right.
arthritis creators, but they sounded good. The three of us cut the basic tracks. Dave Thoner produced, and Race to Paradise got recorded, and it was a really, I thought it was a really good record.
So Wired Up comes out in 87. Now, this is really the thriving period of time for this type of music. Was there supposed to be a follow-up in 89 with this lineup or with yourself?
Not possible. Not by 89. The record that should have been the hit was Race to Paradise. And it is the better record, but Wired Up, produced by Tony Platt and mixed by Bob Rock, ended up getting more visibility.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
Ashby, a lot more visibility. And the label. And Alan did a lot of independent promotion, you know. So
I could tell you as a fan from the time, I didn't even know at the time that there was a Jeff Paris. And I was really into this stuff because that first album was hard to find. It didn't get any type of like push. And when Wired Up came out, it did. And it took me a long time to even realize that there was an album before it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now you know the story. Politics killed that record. Because there was an absolute hit. My Girl should have been a hit. I mean, you know, all the rock bands hated their ballads being hits, but better a ballad hit than no hit at all.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was artistically, you know, I'd had longer to work on it. I like the record more personally. But I Can't Let Go, which you probably hate off of that Wired Up record, would have been a radio hit.
I actually liked the Wired Up record a lot, to tell you the truth. I thought there was some great songs on there. The first song itself is great.
What is the first song?
Saturday Night.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that song. It's a great song.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so funny, man. I got the idea because when I was a kid, one of the folk songs we learned was Everybody Loves Saturday Night.
That's the same. It's the same group.
And I just went, it's I'm going to mine that. Night. I'm just going to lift that right there.
Yeah.
So, and I did one tour, and I'm glad I did. By that time, so I got Matt Sorum to be my drummer. He had been in a band called Why Can't Tori Read?
Oh, yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. It was this little, you know, local thing that, you know, kind of a chick that was somewhere along the lines of I can't remember her name. She played piano.
Tori Amos.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a kind of a Tori Amos kind of a knockoff thing, I think. But Matt was, I recognized the skills.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very quickly. Oh. And he was kind of living hand to mouth, and something happened where he had to leave, you know, he had to split his apartment, and he got to rehearsal. He goes, man, I got to find a place to stay, but I don't have enough money. And I said, well, stay with me. So we lived together for a year.
Really?
we lived together. I had this big, I rented the place because they had this big converted garage, this giant living room, and we'd play there and run some songs down, and Gary Moon, you know. I saw Gary Moon playing at a local rock club here in Los Angeles called Sash, and just loved him. Love at first sight. Great guy.
Great and, talent, too. And then he went out in a nice career with Night Ranger, and he was a good singer himself.
He's great. We sang harmonies together on my record and live, and man, what a great sidekick he was. Just
didn't
great.
Did he end up doing Three Dog Night years later?
Yes.
Did he play with them?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
That was a terrific band. So now this album comes out in 87. This is like, you know, the epitome of the hair band era. Hate the term, but, you know, 87.
You know, the shit is getting ready to hit the fan.
Well, do you hate it as much as yacht rock?
I think I do hate it as much as yacht rock.
Wait, what did I miss?
Well, Tom doesn't like the hair
I
band
hate the term
moniker.
hair band, but I only used it because 87 was really like, that was the year.
Here's the
So.
thing, Tom. Yeah, it's reductive, but hair was, if you the three things that define the music.
Yes.
So you could have called it, heavy guitar or whatever, but
Arena rock, you know.
But you know the thing is,
it.
Jeff, back in the day we didn't call it that. It became a term. It
Oh.
started as a derogatory term in the
Just
90s.
called it rock.
We just called it rock. And I still love the term rock. I hate heavy metal, I hate hair band, I hate rock, yacht rock. I hate all those terms. To me it's just rock.
Well, heavy metal came out in a lyric, in Born to Be Wild, Heavy
Yes.
Metal Thunder.
Yes.
So it comes by it honestly, but really, hair band came out when we were in the shoot of the transition to the Seattle thing.
Yes,
And
absolutely.
so you
Came out
couldn't
in around
call
93.
it was a way to, I mean, people who like Sub Pop, and 90s rock hate grunge, and we hate hair. But the thing about it is it does effectively visually identify the
Yes.
look of the band.
I guess. Yeah, I
Yes. Or
guess. No,
you could
it's
have
yeah.
called
When
it
you, if you had someone who didn't know
spandex
anything,
rock,
yeah.
and then you called the other one flannel rock.
Yeah.
I mean,
But there were a lot of bands that were lumped into hair band, like King's X, Saigon Kick, bands that they definitely weren't of that sound, but they still got lumped into that
oh, it's because they were out at that time.
because they were out at that time. Any band that came out, if you were in your 20s and you had long hair, you were a hair band, and there were a lot of bands that didn't have that sound at all. Right. So I know Mark wanted to talk to you about what you're currently up to, which is a little bit different than some of the things we spoke about.
Well, but except that I grew up after the folk revolution came the blues revolution. That's when Taj Mahal was playing at my high school. He played at my high school the same year Strawberry Alarm Clock did. And Umasekela. They
And I
all
heard you
played.
mention Johnny Winter before, who's a big personal favorite of mine.
Yeah. Well, my, one of my saint, icons is Edgar.
Me
I mean,
too.
I'm an Edgar super freak. And lost my train of, oh, you're talking about the blues thing. So when I was in high school, I immersed myself in blues. I had a great, this guy, Rick Fleischman. He was a couple of years older than me. He was a senior in high school. I was a, freshman and a junior. And he was given lessons to a lot of people. He charged $5 a lesson. He lived near Pali High. And I said, Rick, I want to take lessons from you. And he was just like Marvin Hamlisch. We got to his house, his horribly messy room, and he says, "What are you listening to?" And I said, "That new band, The Doors, just to give you a little place and time." Light My Fire wasn't even out. I was into "You're Lost, Little Girl" with that great arpeggio.
They're talking like
Yes.
1966.
So, maybe it was a little after that, but I was just getting into the Doors, and he says to me, "The Doors," and I go, "Well, what should I be listening to?" He says, he writes down on a piece of music paper, "B.B. King Live at the Regal," and then he wrote, "B.B. King Blues is King." So the Live at the Regal record, you guys probably know about. It's the literally the Bible of how to play a blues gig live and what the audience is capable of responding to if you do it right. The audience is also the biggest character on the record. They're hanging on to every note, and he is showing you how to do it. Doesn't mean you can do it, because everybody's got charisma and some aren't born with it. So the other album was a studio version. I listened to it for 5 seconds. It was stiff. But that gig, I learned every song off it. And then I started getting into Taj. And then I started getting into, James Cotton and harmonica playing. I was the kid, the 14-year-old kid on my bike going down to Westwood Music to buy harmonicas. And I bought a harmonica book and I started playing blues harp and I learned how to, the proper way to play cross harp. The book was written by a guy, oh God, he was in Greenwich Village at the time. I'll tell you later. Blues harmonica. It's slipping my mind. But this is another great influence, even though I never met the man. I'm turning the pages and he has diagrams and showing you how to do single notes and play chords and how to use your vibrato. And then you flip the page and he says, "Can white people play the blues?" I'd never given it a thought because I was clear like water. I have no, I just, I'm like Mr. Natural. I just love everybody and I have no idea about, I just thought there were certain members in my class that spent a lot of time at the beach and they had these great tans. I literally didn't even know what it was. And I wasn't sheltered. It's just, I just to take them as they come guy.
No.
And I love the music and I love the spirit of the music. And I had been given the, the touch of electricity about African American culture, which I didn't realize at the time. But I got brought up short and I was shocked. And he explained where the music came from and why the music was created. And he talked a little bit about Black history in America. And I became, as not to be repetitive, but if I'm not for a loop about something that I never thought of and feel that there's an insurmountable barrier now, I get very depressed. I was really depressed for a while, but I had to do a lot of thinking about it. So what I started doing was I started reading up. I said, well, if I'm going to play this music, I'm going to read up on Black history. And I read Great Slave Narratives and I, read W.E.B. Du Bois and I read Invisible Man and I took African American literature and I studied African civilization. And I ended up in the Crenshaw District playing a lot of R&B gigs with a greater sense of community. Not only that, my uptight parents who had deprived me of a music education were these, vanilla, and like I said, they redeemed themselves with later support, but I was struggling for some kind of community that recognized my goals. And I found it in the Black community. And my first gig was with the Bill Clayton Orchestra. I was the reverse Oreo in the band. Here's a picture. This is the Bill Clayton Orchestra.
Okay.
All right. There's the Bill Clayton Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
And Jeff is playing guitar and Farfisa organ.
Wow.
I spent 3 years playing with those guys. And that guy next to me, the slick looking guy, was the Dynamic Tex. He was one of my best buddies. And Rodney, the drummer, was my age. We were both teenagers. Bill is the guy in the middle, actually, one next to the right. He was like a uncle to me or something. And, this was my sort of little musical family.
Wow.
And that pretty much expresses my approach to everything. All right. So what I'm trying to say with this sort of, sidebar is that I had gone through a very deep experience playing blues, soul, and R&B, and really immersed myself in not only Delta blues and harmonica playing. All this happened before I turned 20. So I took my blues with me into everything I did, whether it was disco writing, whether it was pop writing, And my biggest, vocal influence for a long time was Stevie Wonder and, Marvin Gaye. And I'm not saying anything that Lou Gramm hasn't said whenever asked about, what somebody would say, like, "You guys are incredible." He goes, "Man, we're just standing on the shoulders of giants." And they'd say, "What do you mean?" He goes, like, "Man, Motown, Marvin Gaye, all the great soul singers, David Ruff and the Temptations." And I shedded all those years copying note for note John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. Well, Coco Montoya spent 3 years playing with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. And
He
we were
came full
born.
circle in that one.
So I just, yeah, to me, it was, to me, it's just coming home. So basically, well, so historically, what happened is I emerged out of the 90s. That was a tough decade because I did a couple of more indie records, and then there was a good 5 year period where it was like we didn't know what was going on. It was like Black Friday in the record business every Friday. You'd see the executives walking up the street. It was like labels were tanking, digital piracy on top of that. We forgot about that. That was, what we've lived through. And you guys, are significantly younger than me, but you know enough about it to know that, they actually tried to make a TV show that was this sort of crazy acid thing with a couple of really great actors, and Andrew Dice Clay was in it. He played a record exec. You remember that? It was just chaos. The show was chaotic, but they were trying to give you the feeling
Oh, you're
of
talking about that HBO show? It only lasted one season.
yeah. It was it was
Vinyl.
it was
Vinyl, it was
Vinyl.
called.
Yeah, Vinyl.
It was a
But
great
Vinyl,
show. Yes.
but yeah, Vinyl, in spite of its over-the-top loony thing, correctly captured the feeling of disco to 80s to 90s grunge, and then piracy and the failure of the markets, and then the Y2K, and then
Yeah, it was a great show.
it's right. But
Ray
we're in a
Romano was in
situation.
that show too. Ray Romano was in it,
That's
Andrew Dice
right.
Clay.
That's right. The 400-pound gorilla in this whole room, since we've kind of ventured far from whatever
Oh, we've
I'm
covered the whole gamut, so yeah.
But the point is the 400-pound gorilla in the room is the demonetization of intellectual property. It's terrible. The streamers, the poor royalty rates. Creativity is undervalued, and we're kind of like the rebels in Star Wars. We've had to go underground. But getting back to Coco Montoya, I'm one of, the two of us were born both in the same hospital 3 months apart in Santa Monica. So I went home to Jimmy Van Heusen that night, and he went back to Santa Monica, and his parents took him to the beach when he was a little kid, I guess. So we have a lot of we our musical repertoire of influences is very similar, and we both shedded the same shit, and he was with Mayall, and before Mayall, he was with Albert Collins. First, he played drums with Albert Collins, and then he played guitar with Albert Collins. It's been about 4 or 5 years, and then Mayall discovered him, and I think he was with Mayall even longer than 3 years. Might have been 5 or 6, and
I
he
saw
really.
Albert Collins at the Lone Star Cafe in 1980 or 1981.
Yeah, he's an arresting looking guy, man. I saw him in the 60s, at the Santa Clara Pop Festival or something.
He was a wild guy. He got up on the bar in the Lone Star Cafe, and he was walking up and playing up and down the bar. People were removing their drinks, and he was, and he was probably, I guess, at the time, probably in and around, probably close to 60, if not. But he was
Nah, he wasn't 60. Didn't win.
81.
I don't know. He's passed away now, and
He was probably in his late 50s. He was not a young guy. I mean, maybe not 60,
Now,
but
50 sounds right.
yeah, he definitely was in his
But
50s.
I was fascinated with Albert when I saw him. He kind of looked like a cross between a,
I was
I
a
don't
real
know,
strange looking dude, yeah.
Marvin, like maybe a like Pickett,
Yeah.
if Mom's Mabley was
And
Pickett,
he had the straightened hair with the part on the side, and he had the
the
little
conk.
goatee. Yeah.
Yeah, he was. I
The
think he was.
Iceman. That's what they used to call him, was the
That's right. He's
Iceman.
the Iceman, and he might have been, part Native American too. I think there was
Well, that's
something
what he
like
kind of
that.
looked like. He had the really high cheekbones. He was a strange looking guy. He was a very distinctive looking character. And
But
he was a very distinctive player, too.
player and singer, and the songs that he chose, just really, really something. So Coco does a tribute to him. We play with Ronnie Baker Brooks, who's another big Chicago blues guy. Plays kind of a little bit more like he shreds, really, honestly, great player. And then at the end of the show, we do a tribute to Albert. So I play B3 keys and guitar in that band. I'm featured guitar player in Coco's set. So I play the solos on two songs, and I've co-written a lot of the songs and produced the last record. And so I formally joined Coco's band in 2019. About maybe 10 years before that, I produced a record with Keb Mo on him called I Want It All Back. And it is a record that your blues version of yourself would say, "Oh, that's the one record I hated, too pop." So the idea was that we were going to give him something that could give him a radio hit, and
Yeah.
it is a good record. It is a really good record. But joining him in 2019 was my literally first time I was in a van for the whole tour at 69
Yeah.
years old.
That
You
can't be
know,
easy.
well, it has been easy. This year was a little harder than normal, but so that's it. That was a like I came full circle in a way.
Interesting. No.
And the easiest thing I do in life is, play a 12 bar, Not everybody can do it.
Yeah.
And so now, again, we covered this already, but the real deep time I'm spending is developing a straight ahead jazz repertoire on piano and not singing all instrumental. And I have no business doing it, especially according to those guys who told me that I shouldn't try going to college because I don't have the proper technique and reading ability. And that's exactly what real bebop calls for, but it
Well,
turns out they may be wrong about that. Plus,
you're reinventing yourself yet again. How many times
that's the
now?
magic word, Mark. That is the
Yeah.
magic word. And oh, but I did do a melodic hard rock. I don't think Tom would like it, but I work with Tommy Dinander a
Oh,
lot.
we
No, I
just
have the
that's a great
I do like
yeah.
that. You got to remember what I said before. That was like when I was I'm fucking
22
with
years old. Yeah. I had
Those four songs
the
are great.
Radioactive album,
Yeah.
the new one.
Right. The new
I
one,
have it.
it's called Reboot,
Yeah,
or
it's terrific.
yeah, those four songs you did were great.
Yes.
yeah, I especially like Shame on Me, Shame
The
on
first
You.
track, yeah.
Yeah. But actually the song that I really had a lot of excitement about was called Jaya.
Yes, yeah.
And I want to ask Tommy if it's okay for me to maybe release the version of it that I play, that I sang my vocal to, because the mix was quite a bit different than the original concept of the song. And it doesn't have the heavy Def Leppard drum on it, so that you can really hear this. Tommy wrote a beautiful track, and he played beautifully. And God, I hope he doesn't see this. He's going to get mad at me. I love you, man. I like the mix. I do love the mix. It's great. I just like the other mix too. But it's a really beautiful song, and it's a really heartfelt lyric, basically. If you really read the lyric, you'll see what I'm talking. I don't want to give it away, so you'll have to figure it
Did
out
you
for
have a
yourself.
hand in any of those four songs as far as writing?
I wrote all the lyrics and the melody for
You
all of them.
did. Okay.
Yeah. I thought that everybody did that with Tommy, but then I found out that he's got some what's his face? Dellen. He's a great lyricist. I like him a lot. Nice guy. Some of the Swedish buddies. But with me, we co-write everything. Tommy's the guy that writes songs musically. You know, if he was like when he writes a track, it's like, oh shit, I would have, that's my thing. I would have done that. But I don't have to. Tommy did it. So save me the trouble.
There
You
you
know, I you know, and I always tell him, man, I don't want to do another, you know, I told you that was my last AOR record. I'm done, you
Well,
know.
you did the previous Radioactive with him. You did two songs. This one you did four. So the next time he does one, you're gonna have to sing six. But there is one thing, and I can't let you go without hearing a story about this. 2008, you did a promo tour, Ringo Starr. Tell us about that. What's that
Okay.
like?
So my wife, Lena, she is working at one of the premier entertainment law firms, Ziffrin Brittingham and whatever it's called, and they are a fantastic law firm, really, just really brilliant. And this guy, Mike Bradford, calls her up and says, you're married to Jeff Paris, right? And she says, yeah. I said, well, I'm looking for a keyboard player, and I was just gonna ask you to give me, you know, his phone number. And she goes, yeah, here it is. So Mike calls me up and he goes, hey, I'm putting a band together for Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics. And I go, oh, really? That's great. The Eurythmics. He goes, well, it's not gonna be with Annie Lennox. Well, that's like playing with Rufus, but no Chaka, you know. However, he said, it's gonna be good. We're gonna fly to the UK, and we're gonna do a couple of concerts there. And you know, he you know, he's so that's how that started. Well, it turns out during that time that Dave was also flying back to the UK to work with Ringo, and he produced Liverpool 8, which is Ringo's, one of Ringo's records. And it's a great record, man. It is so killer. Can't remember when he, oh, we were on this yacht owned by Paul Allen, the Microsoft guy, Bill Gates' partner. He's the guy that actually wrote Windows or whatever. You know the guy? Died. But he's also from Seattle and fucking loves Hendrix. We played guitars together. So I'm out on the Octopus, this one of the biggest privately owned boats in the world, which has a recording studio on it, and we're recording a record with Dave. And Randy Cook from Five for Fighting's on it. And so, you know, it's on Bermuda, and I don't know, some people love boats. I hate to be anywhere where I can't leave. So I'm not a boat guy. But I made it through, and at the end, he said, everybody gather around. Ringo needs to do a promo tour in January, and he wants to use the band. Can you guys do it? We all went, yeah. And so sure enough, you know, we go home for Christmas, and then we flew to the UK and landed, and that night we met for dinner, and in walks Ringo. And you know, I've never gotten nervous around any guy ever, no matter how famous. But Ringo, I could barely hold it together. Now, if I was standing, you know, 15 feet away or 20 feet away, I was okay, because then he was about the same size as he was on TV. And, you know, I was used to seeing that. But when you see Ringo standing in front of you and you think about all of those drum hooks and all of that. Absolutely, talk about a creative, incredible guy. Just brilliant musically, just drumming. And then he's got this great voice, which people don't recognize, which is he just has a fantastic pocket in his singing, you know. So we played this 2 week junket, which included Liverpool had gotten what they call the City of Culture Award that week. So I meet Ringo at the hotel restaurant, and then the next day we played the City of Culture festival in this giant, you know, thing the size of, you know, bigger than the Forum. And that was incredible. And at one point I played a 12-string guitar patch that I use in one of the songs on my synth. And you know, Ringo said, "I think I need to hear the keyboards a little louder." So I played it again. He goes, "No, the keyboards." I played it again. I wasn't sure what he was saying. The keyboards. And then I said, "Oh, that is the keyboards." He goes, "Fucking hell, man. Sounds just like a 12-string guitar." And then he says, "Let me see." And he comes over and he's like, you know, he's 5 inches tall across the stage. And then he gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And he's there standing in front of me. I just almost fainted, man. I just had no defense against the Ringus. It was insane. So we played there, and then we flew to America, and we did a shitload of stuff in New York. Rachael Ray, Regis, and that's where Ringo walked off the Regis Philbin show. And everybody, you know, was so surprised because he's known as the nice Beatle, but they were being an asshole to him. They wanted him to shorten the song, and we did shorten the song, and then, you know, that guy Gelman, who was sort of the line producer that has the headset on, and who's now become a kind of a character in the Regis Philbin show. You know, you remember that Gelman? And Gelman would say, "Yes, Reg, I do." You know, so apparently Gelman had gotten a little bit blasé about, you know, his stature compared to a guy like Ringo, and he kept saying, "Ringo, we got to cut the song down a little bit, or you know what, just strike the song, and we'll just do the interview." And he walks away. And Ringo turns around and he looks it up, looks at all of us, and he says, "Pickle, we're out of here." And I was so proud of him, you know, but I thought, yeah, you know, nobody gives a shit about this guy. It's not his all-star band. So I get back home and I pull up Yahoo News, and I said, "Man, I wonder if there's anything about the Ringo thing, you know, on Yahoo News." And I said, "Well, you know, as soon as it comes up," because we had to wait back in those days, right? And I said, "You know, I'll look in the table of contents." And I, you know, the thing comes up, and the first thing you see is a big picture of Ringo, says, "Not so nice, Ringo Starr." And it was like, I went, "God, I was in on the on a media event." Anyway, so that's how I got that gig.
There you go. Well, Jeff, hey, it's been a marathon session. We got to cut it. I don't know if the Zoom is going to let us go that long anymore, but
I know.
yeah. Hey, we appreciate all these really cool stories and everything.
Well, I've
Really
always
great
tried to
talking
tell
to you.
myself to just, you know, be one word answers, you know, but apparently I'm not able to do it. So I apologize. I'm going to put you
That's
to some
okay.
editing work.
Yeah, there you go. Not a problem. All
Is
right.
there
Well,
anything you guys want to know about anything else?
no, I think
No,
anything
we're good.
we're good. I think we're
All
good.
right. Tom,
Jeff.
thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I
A
apologize
pleasure.
about that Y&T record. I know
It's okay. I warmed up to it over the years.
You know what you do? You just, you know, play it a little bit faster, like have more edge. Mark, thank you very much.
Take care.
All
Thank
right,
you,
you
Jeff.
guys. All right. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Happy New Year.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right.